Hello and welcome to the 2009 Full Frontal Podcast.
Hey, I'm PPK. I run a site called quirksmode.org. I assume some of you know that site. So I've been testing browsers now for 9 years. I've been testing compatibility of browsers, and it's getting better and better in the normal desktop world. And that's a problem for me, because I was getting bored. I mean, I did a series of updates back in February or March, and everything just worked in every browser, even in IE8, yes, even in IE8. And for you, that's wonderful, because it means you can actually use stuff in your websites. But for me, it's pretty boring, because I want to find one really juicy bug during every single time I update my browser compatibility tables. Fortunately, the gods interfered, and they sent me Vodafone. Back in February, I was contacted by Vodafone Services Global, which is the software department of Vodafone. And they said, okay, we've got some trouble with mobile browsers. We're working on mobile browsers and W3C widgets. I had no idea what those were back then, but I do know now, and I'm going to tell you. And we'd like you to come over to Düsseldorf to please help us out. And we've got a lot of mobile phones there. You can test all of them if you want to. This is just one of the closets. They have several of those. So I came, I saw, and I discovered the mobile web. And that's what I'm going to talk about you today. I'm going to talk some JavaScript, but not much of it. So instead, I want to give you a very broad overview of where the mobile web is right now, technically. First of all, I am very excited about the mobile web. As far as I'm concerned, it's an extremely interesting thing that's happening right under our noses now. I mean, we know the desktop web by now. We know what people have a computer, and they sit in front of it, and they call on a website, and they do nice stuff over there. But once we get into the mobile world, we're going to talk about context. We're going to talk about, okay, somebody is walking on the street and then calls on your website. Should your website keep track of that context, and should it do something interesting then? For instance, one obvious instance is geolocation. In the future, a website can be able to read your exact location on the planet and, for instance, give you restaurants that are located close by you. You could just do that in a website in the future. The only problem we're having with the mobile web right now is that we don't have the faintest idea what we're doing, both technically and conceptually. I'm not really going to talk about a concept and a strategy here, but briefly, I think that we do not know yet what the mobile web will be good for. It will be good for viewing normal websites, say your Gmail account or whatever, that works fine on mobile even today. But I think there will be many more interesting stuff coming along in the future, except that we still have to figure out exactly what will be coming along. And that will be your job in the near future. What are we going to do with the mobile web? We will figure it out eventually. Today we are going to talk more about technical issues. I have been testing browsers, mobile browsers now for 9 months. Those of you who follow me on Twitter know that I can swear and curse profusely every once in a while, because some mobile phones are worse than others. Of course, I concentrate on the mobile browsers. That's one of the problems I'm having right now with how the mobile world, the mobile industry, is moving right now. You've got all kinds of information online about mobile devices, but they all concentrate on the device and not on the browser. And I think that is a conceptual mistake. I could be wrong. I mean, I'm still in the process of figuring it out. But it could be that we have to concentrate on the mobile browsers, which, of course, begs the question, which mobile browsers are there exactly? In theory, if you want to create a proper mobile website, it has to work in all these browsers. In practice, that's not going to work. So I'm going to try to give you a slight introduction to web browsers in the mobile world and some very, very important techniques that you can use. First of all, I divided this into two columns. I did that for a reason. Basically, the browsers on the left are the default browsers, and the browsers on the right are non-default browsers, which is not entirely true always, but never mind that for now. If an average user goes to the shop and buys a new mobile phone, with the mobile phone comes one of these default browsers. In order to get a non-default browser, in order to get one of the browsers in the right column, the user actually has to make a conscious decision to download and install that browser, which presupposes that he already knows about that browser and wants to install it. My current guess is that not many people will do that. I could be wrong, and I'm certainly wrong with regards to Opera Mini, because Opera Mini is a bit of a special browser in the sense that it's a good modern browser created for old crappy phones. People, especially in Russia and Asia, are very enthusiastic about it because they can really experience the mobile web on their old, crappy phone. But in general, you can say that you will encounter these browsers a lot because they are default browsers on a certain phone. And these browsers will be in the order of 0.001% of the market. That's the second distinction I want to make. These browsers are all WebKit browsers. Now, that may sound good, and it is good to a certain extent, but the one thing I discovered pretty quickly during my research is that there is no WebKit on mobile. There are all kinds of different WebKits on mobile, iPhone, Android, 60, Iris, Palm, etc., etc., and they are all slightly different. The problem we're having with WebKit right now is if you take a certain branch of WebKit, you can do that for free. It's a free browser, after all. But first of all, you have to choose your branch. Then you have to port it to the specific phone or phones you want to install it on. And then, when you're ready to actually compile the browser, you have to set 120 switches to yes or no. And of course, everybody makes a slightly different decision on which switch to set to yes or no. And that's where the differences in WebKit mobiles come from. In any case, the details don't much matter. What I'm saying to you right now is that if somebody says, yeah, my website should work on WebKit on mobile, laugh in his face, because he has no idea what he's talking about. Small example, I've devoted a lot of time recently to figuring out the exact differences between various WebKit browsers. And these are all mobile WebKits. Yes, a 60 of Nokia, the iPhone, the Android, several smaller WebKits, and a Palm Pre. And as you can see, they are all slightly different. The differences are not huge. I mean, these are mostly methods and properties and CSS declarations that are very useful every once in a while, but that you can do without if you really try. But still, the message I'm sending to you is there is no WebKit on mobile. As far as I'm concerned, the mobile browser market now is in a bit of a fight between WebKit and Opera. And the difference between the two browsers is fairly interesting. Also on the technical side, but I'm now talking more on the business side. As I said before, WebKit is free. Everybody can download it, but everybody also has to create his own version, which means that there are huge differences between the browsers. Opera, on the other hand, it's free for us consumers. We can all download an Opera if it's available for our specific phone. But if as an operator or a vendor you want to use Opera, you usually have to pay for it. So it's more like a closed source thing. You cannot just download Opera source code. The advantage of that is that there's one nucleus of Opera functionality that is supposed to be working on all devices, whether desktop or mobile. In practice, there are some slight differences, but when you compare it to the various WebKit implementations, these differences are nothing. So what I'm expecting right now is that if we add the market shares of Opera and WebKit, that we arrive at, say, 70 to 80% of the mobile market in the near future. Again, all these WebKits are slightly different and are good and bad implementations. But still, it helps us a lot making sense of it all. There are, of course, many, many other browsers. I mean, say, 10 years ago, everybody was creating his own browser. Those were WAP browsers then, and WAP is a crappy system that you should forget as soon as possible, but it was very popular 10 years ago. And everybody thought, oh, cool, let's make our own browser because, well, that will be cool, you know, because we'll have our own browser or whatever. And we are left with a legacy of that. There are several browsers that are still around and that have been created by, say, a mobile vendor or a company that has strong ties with mobile vendors. We'll see one of those later on. But the point is that we are suffering under a surfeit of crappy browsers on the mobile front. Fortunately, something is changing here. BlackBerry is a pretty important phone because it has roughly 20% of the mobile of the smartphone market. And the BlackBerry browser, unfortunately, is pretty crappy. I mean, it's good when you test, say, document.getElementById, yeah, no problem. Get elements by tag name, no problem. But once you actually try to run a website on it, it turns out that the performance is just lousy. Fortunately, BlackBerry itself has figured that out too, and they have decided to buy Torch Mobile, and Torch Mobile are the creators of the Iris browser, which is one of those tiny WebKit browsers. So in the future, in the not too distant future, I'm guessing, BlackBerry will also move to a WebKit browser, which will be all to the better, because any WebKit browser is better than a BlackBerry browser. So we can forget about BlackBerry. Then Mozilla and its Gecko engine. Mozilla is, of course, an excellent browser. We all know that. But the problem right now is that it's very late to the game of mobile. I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago that they started up a project called Minimo in order to create a mobile browser. But they stopped that project again for reasons that are unclear to me. And about a year and a half ago, they started up a new project called Fennec, which has now by now created a Fennec browser, a beta 5 browser, which only runs on Linux phones, on the Nokia Linux phones. So they have a pretty good browser, but they have only a very slight percentage of the smartphone market covered right now. Everybody is saying that they will move to Android pretty soon. I hope they will. But the problem remains that Mozilla is very late to the game, and they just don't have any market share to speak of. NetFront. NetFront is still an important browser, and it's one of those browsers I talked about earlier, one of the browsers that was created by a company named Axis, a Japanese company, which has very strong ties with various browser vendors, notably Sony Ericsson and Samsung. It's still being used as the default browser on many older Sony Ericsson devices. The problem is it's pretty crappy. We will see some interesting screenshots of the NetFront browsers later on. Then we've got IE. Fairly recently, this year, I think, Microsoft created a new operating system for mobile, Windows Mobile 6.5, which is a hell of a lot better than Windows Mobile 6.1. And they also created a new browser version, IE Mobile 6, which is actually based on IE 6. And it's a hell of a lot better than the previous IE Mobile, which was based on IE 4. So we actually see progress there. But still, the most modern Microsoft browser available right now is IE6 based. I'm in touch with Microsoft mobile platform, and I've immediately said in my second or third email to them, okay, I assume you know you have a problem because your browser is ancient and web developers are not much going to like it. And they said, yeah, I guess so. I mean, I'm hoping that Microsoft will see the error of its ways and that the mobile guys are going to cooperate with the desktop guys to bring, say, IE8 or the upcoming IE9 to the mobile platform. Until that time, there's nothing much we can do for the poor people who have only IE Mobile installed. Fortunately, it turns out that most of the device vendors who use Windows Mobile know about the problems with IE Mobile and also install Opera on their devices. So usually people with a Windows Mobile device also have Opera and can surf the web normally. And I'm not going to talk about minor browsers because they're even worse. It was about 3 months ago that I decided to do a little test. I took my own homepage, which you see here in Firefox, just normal desktop Firefox. I would load my own homepage in the various mobile browsers, make screenshots of them, and just see what happened. And there are some pretty interesting results. Let's start with a good browser. This is Safari on the iPhone. And, of course, it renders my homepage pretty well. It zooms out completely. It tries to encompass the entire page, which means that initially the text is unreadable. But that's no problem. You can just zoom in and read the text anyway. So it works fine in Safari iPhone. BlackBerry. BlackBerry tries to do the same, but doesn't quite succeed. As you see, my footer here doesn't really work. I have no idea why it should stretch across the entire page. This whole blue column should stretch down to the bottom. I have no idea why the BlackBerry browser doesn't show it, but it doesn't. And frankly, I think this is now typically an example of progressive enhancement. I want my website or mobile to look like this, but if it looks like this, I mean, there's only one real problem here. The text here is white, and on the BlackBerry, that text is unreadable. But once I solve that problem, I have made my homepage more or less compliant with the BlackBerry browser. I mean, this is an important lesson, actually, that we'll have to learn. We're all talking about progressive enhancement and stuff, but we still try to get our website to work on every single desktop browser. Once we go to the mobile world, we have no choice but to really, really use progressive enhancement, because your website will never, ever work perfectly on all mobile devices. It will just be impossible by the sheer amount of devices and browsers that are out there. So we really have to start thinking about progressive enhancement here. And I think this is actually a pretty good example of progressive enhancement. It doesn't work perfectly, but it works once I solve the white text problem. This is the other way of showing my homepage. This is the S60 WebKit, which is the default browser on pretty much any more or less modern Nokia device. Most people of you who have a Nokia device actually have this browser installed. As you see, it doesn't zoom. It doesn't do zoom at all. Instead, it shows the upper left corner of my website. And then I can use the arrow keys. These are actually arrow keys, although they don't look like it, to scroll around to my site. And that all works perfectly, and it looks pretty well. So this is the other way of going about showing a desktop website on a mobile phone. Just show the little bit you can see and allow the user to scroll to the other bits, which kind of works. I mean, it's not a perfect experience, but it works for the users. Especially, and you should never forget that, if you only have one of these Nokia phones, you are used to the web looking like this. And you will, I mean, somebody will show you the iPhone or the Android and say, hey, this looks much better, and you look at it and say, yeah, it looks much better. But still, you are used to this, and it actually works. We come to NetFront now. This is how it looks on a NetFront browser on a Samsung device. It's pretty much the same concept as the Nokia we saw just now. It's the upper left corner of my site. By the way, this blue stuff here is not a bug. It's a feature. It's actually a way of saying, okay, this link is now highlighted, and if you click on the Enter button, which is somewhere here in the keyboard, you will actually follow this link. Basically, it's the dotted outline that we see around our links now, except that NetFront has, for reasons known only to itself, decided to make a blue border and to make this text background also blue. I have no idea why. Anyway, this still is pretty good, but now comes the funny part. Right now, we're looking at the landscape mode of the Samsung device. Let's switch it to portrait mode. Now, all of a sudden, it looks awful. Actually, there's a concept behind this. This, again, is not a bug, it's a feature. What NetFront tries to do here is create a so-called mobile view. I'll show you more mobile views later on. And this mobile view basically means, okay, I take a website, and I try to compress it so that it will fit into the tiny display of the phone. So basically, it forgets about all of my positioning. It disregards some widths I've set in the CSS, and instead it says, okay, I will now show all the elements in the HTML page in source code order. So it starts with my header and this thingy and then my links, and if we go down and down, we see the text, etc., etc., etc. Now, the really weird part here is that I don't understand why NetFront has decided that in landscape mode we get a normal view of the website as it appears on desktop. But in portrait mode, we suddenly get the mobile mode. I have no idea why they did it, but NetFront is known for its odd decisions. For instance, this is a touchscreen device. I have to take a touchscreen device to show you. This is a touchscreen device, you can scroll. On the iPhone and on most other touchscreen devices, if I want to scroll this page, I do this, right? I do this and I scroll. Turns out, on that front, you have to do exactly the opposite. On that front, you have to scroll like this. And then the page goes that way. In theory, that even makes sense. Because what they're doing is emulating the scroll bar. If you use the scroll bar, you do this in order to scroll the page that way. Except, of course, that if you make this gesture on the actual scroll bar itself, it doesn't work. You have to do it here in the main area. So that's the kind of fun things that NetFront thinks of. Again, this is not a bug, this is a feature. I tested several NetFronts on touchscreen devices, and they all had the same problem. So I hope you're starting to understand why I think that NetFront is not a very good browser. But again, if you're used to this browser, if this Samsung F700, which is a weird device, but if it's the only smartphone you've ever seen, you're used to this. And you say, okay, that's just how it works. And you will actually have to get used to the iPhone way of doing things. Okay, this is a mobile mode. Let's take a look at Opera. This is Opera Mobile 9.5 on a Windows mobile device. And as you see, my site looks pretty good again. The footer should be here. Instead, it's somewhere down here. But that's the single bug that it shows. And it could even be a bug in my code. I don't know. Now, Opera also has a mobile mode. What we're seeing right now is a desktop mode in which Opera tries to emulate the desktop view of my website as good as possible. There is a setting somewhere deeply hidden in the settings menu where you can say show it as mobile mode or, well, I forgot the exact text. But in any case, once you set that, you get this. And this is, again, what we saw with the NetFront browser just now. And it's the same concept. We try to squeeze the entire website into the mobile display, into this small, tiny mobile display. And it's totally different. I must admit, I do not really like mobile mode. I can kind of understand why browsers want to implement it, but it makes it very difficult for us web developers to give a consistent look and feel to a website, especially since there's no reliable way to detect whether a browser is in mobile or in desktop mode. Besides, Opera has done some more strange things between desktop and mobile modes. I created a simple CSS testing page because it turned out I actually had to test whether browsers support font style italic. Some browsers do not. So it took me a while to figure that out. In any case, I created this basic CSS test page. This is, again, Opera Mobile in desktop mode and works fine, as you see. Every single CSS declaration is obeyed. If we go to mobile mode, it becomes this. Most of it is still supported, but all of a sudden, font variant, letter spacing, word spacing, and font size are not supported anymore. Now, I can understand font size. I mean, the whole idea of a mobile mode is to squeeze your website into the small display. So I can understand why you say, okay, let's forget about all those funky font sizes. We just make it the default font size of the device. Fine. I'm fine with that. I do not understand, however, why word spacing, letter spacing, and font variant are not supported. I suppose there will be a reason somewhere deeply hidden within the Opera rendering engine, but it's not a reason that's readily apparent to us web developers. And that's one of the many problems we're seeing on mobile. Sometimes there is just something funky going on that you just don't get. I've got one beautiful example of that. This is the Android 1.5. And this is my test of box sizing. Who does not know the CSS box sizing property? Oh, you all do. Oh, cool. So I don't have to explain this. This is just my test. I've drawn some reference boxes here. And the important point is this reference box has a width of 300 pixels, and this one has a width of 330 pixels. This works fine in landscape mode. Now we switch to portrait mode. All of a sudden, the box with width 330 pixels is smaller than the box with width 300 pixels. Now, there's a reason for that, actually. It took me a while to figure it out, but there is a reason for that. It turns out that Android also has a mobile mode. I mean, it's even its default mode. But it does it completely different from either Opera or NetFront. What it basically says here is, okay, I've got the display width of 320 pixels, which is the default display for an Android. This box is 300 pixels wide. So that's fine. I'll just show it. This box, however, is 330 pixels wide, which means we have to scale it a little bit. which means that you cannot actually trust on all your with statements to be properly implemented by this browser. Now, again, there's a setting somewhere deeply hidden in the in the Android settings menu where you can actually set it to the desktop mode, and then it does work properly. But again, this is one of the many problems you will encounter when you try to create a mobile website. I mean, it's fun, right? You all love this. You think, oh, yeah, I want to go into the mobile web and kind of solve all these problems and write good articles about it and make everybody happy. Okay, let's take a look at one extremely important tool for the mobile web, which are media queries. Who knows media queries here? Okay, about half. Basically, it's very simple, the whole concept. Let's say your website has a sidebar. It's 300 pixels wide, and it's floated right of the main column. Now, on mobile, this is not going to work because the display is too small. Suppose you know that, and you say, okay, I'm going to use a media query to change all that. Basically, what you do is this. This is a media query. You don't even know, need the all. You can also say print or whatever, but let's keep it to all right now. Add media all, and now comes the important part, if the width of the page is a maximum of 400 pixels. If that is the case, then we say, okay, we forget about this width, and we forget about the float. Instead, we just show the sidebar in the natural flow of the page. I mean, you can do anything with it. You just have a nested div.sidebar rule here that says, okay, the sidebar should look like this when the screen is 400 pixels or narrower. This is an extremely important tool because it will allow you to distinguish between various monitor resolutions. You make a normal site just for 1024 by 768, as usual, but then you can say, okay, if the monitor size is, say, around 800 pixels, I change a few things. And if it's around 400 pixels, which means we're really on a mobile device right now, then I change some more. And there's even some very old mobile phones that have even smaller resolutions. So what you can do here is create a kind of a graded, I'm not yet sure how to call it, so let's call it a graded design, in which you start out pretty wide and then say, okay, if it becomes smaller, I will place the navigation at the bottom. And if it becomes even more smaller, I will also place the sidebar at the bottom. And if it becomes even more smaller, I will change the header or whatever. I mean, this is really a design problem, a graphic design problem. I'm not a graphic designer, so I can't tell you how to do it. But the whole concept is extremely powerful. And actually, media queries are reasonably well supported among the modern mobile browsers. Opera supports it, and all of the modern WebKits support it. So if you use media queries, you can actually be reasonably certain that all modern browsers will follow your instructions. Okay, which kind of media queries are there? We already saw max width and min width. Min width 400 would basically mean if the screen is larger than 400 pixels, if the minimum width of the screen is 400. The problem is that it's not really the screen width we're testing here, but the page width. And it turns out that there can be a difference between the two. For instance, on the iPhone, every single page is 960 pixels wide. Even if you zoom in, which means that adding media query that uses max width and min width will say, okay, the device is 960 pixels wide, so that's a media query I'll use. Well, the user actually sees a much narrower version of the site. This is a terribly complicated problem. I'm doing research on this at the moment, but I haven't finished yet. I hope to publish before the end of the year. But there are some really tricky problems involved in the width of your website on a mobile device and media queries and also stuff like offset width and client width that we use in JavaScript to measure parts of our sites. There are some tricky problems there, and I'm going to get back to that later. In any case, a slightly safer solution is max device width and min device width. Excuse me. Now we're actually taking the width and height of the device as a measurement. And this is somewhat more reliable on all phones that support media queries. So if you want to use media queries right now, I advise you to use max device width and min device width, or height, of course, if you need that. Then there's orientation. The orientation is either portrait or landscape. Yeah, fun, but it's not really useful, I think. because what we actually need to know is how wide the screen is. Then we've got aspect ratio, which is the same. It's interesting, kind of, but it's also not really what we're looking for, especially because there's so many values of aspect ratio. These are the values I found when I tested the aspect ratio in all WebKit browsers, both on desktop and on mobile. 2 to 3, 3 to 4, 4 to 5, 3 to 5, 10 to 6, and 80 to 99, which I believe is the iPhone. I mean, if you don't know this, you're never going to figure it out. I mean, I had to actually calculate the width and height of the screen, divide it, and see what kind of aspect ratio came up. So I don't think aspect ratio is really important. Finally, and this one is important, DPI. We have all grown used to a web browser and a computer monitor having 96 DPI resolution. It turns out that what exactly 96 DPI means is rather vague. There's somebody at Vodafone who's doing great research on this, and I hope he publishes his result, because I don't really understand the whole point of DPI, and especially how it's implemented in the current browsers. In any case, on mobile, it's much, much more complicated, because some phones have a far larger DPI. As I'm saying up to 200, but I think I actually found a phone that has a DPI of 277. Which means that the whole display is not much larger than the iPhones, but it has a much higher resolution, which means that your sight is much narrower. And it also turns out that you cannot zoom a specific browser on that phone. So what you see is tiny, tiny text and tiny, tiny buttons and tiny, tiny links. And the worst part of it, if I try to click on a button, because I'm trying to do my tests, obviously, I try to click on a button on a link, and usually it doesn't work. Why not? Because one of the big problems we're having on touchscreens right now is the overloading of the touch action. Basically, they are saying, okay, if you touch the touch screen, it may mean anything. It may mean that you want to actually click on something. It may also mean that you want to start scrolling. And it turns out that particular browser, if I move my finger even a few pixels during the touch, it thinks, oh, the user wants to start scrolling, so I'd better not follow that link. Which means that basically you have to keep on... I mean, I'm literally sitting in Vodafone's offices like this. I'm trying, I don't know, I'm going on for a minute, and sometimes when I'm really, really lucky, it actually follows the link. And that's a problem with both far too high DPI setting and the fact that it's very, very hard to differentiate between the start of a click action and the start of a scroll action. Anyway, that's media queries. One more example. Suppose we have a font size of 0.8em, whatever, and something normal for normal websites. We can add this media query. We can say if the resolution is 150 dpi or higher, we set the font size of the body to 2em. And that's what I actually did on that specific browser I was talking about. I actually said, okay, I'm just going to up the font size a lot because that will make everything larger and the buttons did become marginally more clickable. Okay, let's talk briefly about JavaScript. First of all, the good news is that modern mobile browsers support JavaScript. They support it even pretty decently. When I started my research back in February, I thought, okay, now I'm going to find horrendous bugs. Turns out that was not quite true. I mean, what I'm doing is atomic tests. That is, I take one method or property and see whether it's supported or not. Does this browser support document.getElements by tag name? Does it support query selector all, etc., etc.? In these atomic tests, all browsers, including BlackBerry and NetFront, scored pretty decently. I mean, say, query selector all is a really, really novel method. Even on the desktop, all browsers support it only since this year or something, which means that not all mobile browsers support it yet. But that's fine, because that's the same situation we're having on desktop right now. In the more normal cases, like normal DOM methods, normal CSS selectors and declarations, it turns out that the compatibility is pretty decent, much, much better than I expected when I started my research. I mean, these browser vendors all have been actually paying attention to web standards and try to implement them as well as they can. The problem lies in performance. That is by far the most tricky problem you're going to encounter when you try to create a JavaScript application for the mobile web. Basically, any phone has far smaller memory than any desktop computer, which means everything runs more sluggishly, et cetera, et cetera. And there are also some pretty lousy implementations around. I've done exactly one performance test, an extremely simple one. I just generated 250 lists with 20 items each, just through the normal W3C DOM, you know, a pen child. And I measured how long that took the browser. In reference, I also run this test on the IE6 on desktop, which takes between 1 and 1.5 seconds, which is slow for the desktop, but pretty good for the mobile web, as we'll see later on. So how long does this take the browsers? We start here. Frankly, I made up the 500s here. IE Mobile stopped doing my tests after the 88th list. I have absolutely no idea why. And BlackBerry didn't wake up at all. And you couldn't scroll scroll it. I wanted to scroll down to see how many lists it had rendered, but I couldn't even do that. So I have absolutely no clue what's going on, except that their performance is totally lousy. Now, the slowest phone that actually gives a result is, again, that Netfront browser. And it takes it 97 or nearly 100 seconds to render 250 lists with 20 list items each. And then we go down to more normal values. Let's take a brief look at the normal values. Again, IE6 on the desktop takes 1.3 seconds to run this test. The very best mobile browser I found is Opera 9.6 on the new Samsung H1 device. Samsung H1 is also known as the Vodafone 360. They're doing a huge marketing campaign about it now. I've been testing this thing since May. It was the thing I was talking about earlier with the huge DPI settings, which do not run on Opera. And we see some interesting differences here. First of all, the iPhone is pretty slow, and I hadn't expected that. Secondly, the one that's pretty fast is the S60 browser, which is an old WebKit. It's been branched off from the WebKit branch, I believe, in 2005 or so, but it still performs pretty well. So we see huge differences here, and it only goes to show that performance is still very much of an issue on the mobile web. If you want to create a really, really good, cool JavaScript application, take your time. I mean, you can't just port something that you created for the desktop web to the mobile web because it will just run too slowly. One more important rule is don't use iframes. That is because they are performance hogs. As soon as you use an iframe in a mobile browser, it slows down considerably. And that's a problem for several test suites. As you know, it's very fashionable right now to write a JavaScript test suite that tests all kinds of obscure things that nobody else understands. And in general, people put their tests in iframes because that's a kind of a black box, which is a good idea from a methodological point of view, but is horrible for mobile phones. So please don't use iframes. Okay, the problem with the mobile web, and there's a problem that the desktop web does not have, is connections. We here are all within one cell of the mobile network, which means if that if one of us starts downloading a movie to his phone, the connections of all other people here will become slower. And that is a problem that I don't think is going to disappear anytime soon. We are going to get better and better and better networks, obviously. But once we get a better mobile network, not one of you, but five of you will start to download movies. And the network will still become slower for the rest of us. So the problem here is also that connections can suddenly disappear. And this is going to be a huge problem on the mobile web. Fortunately, we already have a solution in place. Don't know if you know them, the online and offline events. Basically, the online events fires when you come online, and the offline events fires when you go offline. The problem right now is that all browsers except for Firefox have implemented it wrongly. I tested this on the desktop browsers only. What I did is I loaded my test page in all the desktop browsers, and then I manually disconnected my network cable and tried to see what happened. In Firefox, the offline event fired. In all the other browsers, it did not. Because in all the other browsers, it turns out that the only way of firing the offline event is to select the work offline option somewhere in the file menu, which is complete nonsense because that's not what the online and offline events are about. In any case, these events are going to be hugely important on mobile. Remember them. I mean, you say you have a Gmail application. If the offline event fires, you make sure that any mail the user sends is temporarily stored locally. And once the online event fires, you say, okay, I take all those locally stored mails and send them to the server. That's the way that we're going to use the online and offline events. Well, connections are a problem because basically every time you visit a website, you have to download all the assets because caching isn't always reliable on the mobile web. Now, the solution here is to put all the core files of your application on your mobile phone and only download the data you need. So in the case of Gmail, you put all the Gmail stuff, the core JavaScript and CSS, you put it on your mobile phone and you only download the actual mail data. That saves a lot of network traffic. The problem is that that doesn't really work in websites because websites always try to download everything they need, including all the JavaScript and all the CSS. And it's here that W3C widgets enter the game. Basically, they are local applications written in HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, run in a browser and can do AJAX requests. So basically, what you have when you create a W3C widget is a website, except that that website runs locally on your phone and only has to fetch the data, which means that there are not many connection problems. And the really fun part is that creating W3C widgets is extremely, extraordinarily easy. You just create one HTML page with all the CSS, JavaScript, and images you need. The only thing is you're restricted to one single HTML page, so you basically create a single page interface for your website. Once you've done that, you add two special things. First of all, an icon, which can be of any graphic format. And the icon is basically what the user sees on the screen and what he has to tap in order to start up your widget. The second thing is a config.xml, and that's the only really new thing you have to learn for widgets. It's basically a way of saying, okay, hi, I'm a widget, and my width and height is this and that, and I'm allowed to access the network, and if you want to update me, you can find an update at this URL. I mean, it'll take you about half an hour to get the config.xml down. Once you've done that, once you've added the icon and the config.xml, you zip the lot, just with normal WinZip. You change the extension to WGT for widget. You upload it to a widget-capable phone, and it works. Really, I've done it. And now comes the really interesting part. I've got a widget that I've created on my S60 phone. I show it to you, and it's, let's say you have a Windows mobile phone. And you say, oh, cool, I want that widget too. Then I can just send it via Bluetooth from my S60 phone to your Windows mobile phone, and it works. And this is not just a pipe dream. I've actually done this. I mean, there are still significant problems, but this whole concept does work. I mean, what we have here is a local application on a mobile phone that's actually interoperable with other types of mobile phones, which means that it's by far the most interoperable app system for mobile phones that exists currently because none of the other application systems work on other phones than where they were designed for. Which begs the question, okay, where do W3C widgets work? They work on S60 phones with the Vodafone Widget Manager, which was the original reason for Vodafone to get me involved in the project. They needed somebody to test the Widget Manager. The Vodafone Widget Manager runs an Opera browser inside in order to actually show the widgets. They work in any phone with Opera Mobile 9.51 or higher installed, which is basically available now for Windows Mobile, for Symbian UIQ, that's the Sony Ericsson operating system, and for Symbian S60, I believe. It also, and this is the really interesting part, runs on Windows Mobile 6.5 phones, because Microsoft has also implemented W3C widgets. Unfortunately, it turns out that there's literally one attribute of difference between the Opera and the Microsoft system. There's one single attribute in the config.xml that Microsoft requires and Opera forbids, which means that they are not totally interoperable as yet. But this is going to change. Even with that problem, W3C widgets are already the most interoperable way of creating mobile phone applications that we have. Besides, there's more in the pipeline. BlackBerry is working on widget support. They're a bit confused right now because they want to wrap the widget up in a Java skin something that interfaces it to the BlackBerry operating system. I don't know. Eventually, I think they want to solve that and want to actually support W3C widgets. Nokia. A few weeks ago, I was at the Nokia MIMO conference. MIMO is the Linux device of Nokia's. And there was a guy talking about widgets, and I asked, will you support W3C widgets in the future? And he said, yes. Which is cool. Palm Pre, it would make sense for Palm to support widgets too, because they're betting their entire future on the web OS, the web development languages as an operating system. Android, I put Android here because I want Android to support widgets, not because they actually do. But Android is pretty much open source, so pretty much anyone could write a widget manager for Android. Of course, it will not work on the iPhone because Apple is evil. Okay, I'm almost there. There's two problems with W3C widgets, and the first one is a common problem for all JavaScript sites: animations. If you want really, really smooth animations for a game or something, just don't use JavaScript because it's just not good enough. The second problem is that we need access to phone functionality. I already mentioned geolocation. And what we could also do is try to access the address book or any other stuff that is on the phone. And that's absolutely vital to the context of the mobile application we want to write. That's why we have device APIs, and they are going to work like this. This is pseudocode, but this is going to be what eventually works. We just access the device via a special JavaScript API. We say, okay, now please call the entry of my address book that's called mom. And it places an actual call. And there will be many more device APIs for the camera and text messaging, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to skip this one. One last point. With these device APIs, they're great, and we absolutely need them for a true mobile context, a true mobile experience, but there's a security problem. Suppose I receive a widget from you via Bluetooth, and I install it and run it. How am I going to know that it's not going to try to steal my vital data and send it off via an AJAX request to a malicious server? The point is, I don't. This is a very serious problem, and they're trying to solve that now in the device API working group of the W3C, but it's going to take a while. That's why I think that device APIs in general will work on widgets, within widgets, before they're going to work on actual websites. Because a widget, you can somehow check a widget, more or less. You can say, okay, this is a widget, and we can control it and say, give it a stamp, approved. There are still security problems with that. But we can do something with widgets, which we can't with websites. So I believe it will be quite a while before normal mobile websites can use device APIs. Still, I think all these problems are basically solvable because I'm an optimist at heart. I strongly, strongly, strongly believe that W3C widgets are actually the future of the mobile web because they combine the benefits of a website, HTML, CSS, JavaScript, web standards, anyone can write it, with the benefits of an application, which basically means it is locally installed. So we have to get to work on W3C widgets. And I thank you so much, and I have no idea if we have time for questions.
I'll let you take one question.
Okay, one question. Who?
Hi. Earlier when you were talking about the mobile mode on browsers and how it sort of screws the things, it was, if I remember right, with things like with Opera Mobile, if you actually provide a style sheet, mobile style sheet for it, it will basically sort of assume you know what you're doing and do what you're asking.
Are you talking about AdMedia Handheld now?
Sorry?
AdMedia Handheld?
The media handheld style sheets, it will sort of listen to. Did you find that the other browsers sort of behave
as
similarly?
As far as I'm concerned, AdMedia Handheld, briefly, AdMedia Handheld is a type of device, just like a print or screen or projection or whatever. You've also got handheld. I believe it's useless, because it makes the wrong distinction. First of all, it's not very well supported. Secondly, what is a handheld device? I mean, an iPhone is clearly a handheld device. My laptop is clearly not a handheld device. But suppose there's a Nokia tablet, which is about this size and has an 800 by 600 resolution. Is that a handheld device, yes or no? As far as I'm concerned, the whole issue at stake is what is the actual resolution of the device. And that's what we can try to find out with the other media queries that I showed. And I believe we should just gradually forget about a media handheld because it's useless.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, that's it.
Thank you, PPK.